From the Sky News Centre at 5, the family of a woman killed in a train crash in Cumbria say they hold Network Rail responsible for her death. An inquest blamed poor track maintenance for the derailment of an express train in 2007. Tim Jones has the story.
Margaret Masson was 84 when she was killed near the village of Greyrick. Nearly 90 people on board the Glasgow to London service were also injured. Her inquest heard workers were often not given enough time to properly check and maintain the lines, and an accident investigation listed numerous failures by Network Rail. A jury ruled badly maintained points caused Mrs. Masson's death.
The jury in the trial of Michael Jackson's Dr. Conrad Murray has been sent out to consider its verdict. He's charged with involuntary manslaughter. He's pleaded not guilty to injecting Michael Jackson with a lethal dose of the anaesthetic propofol. Young people face wildly different prospects depending on their hometown. In some cities, mainly in northern England, up to one in four are so-called NEETs, not in education, employment or training. Report author Neil Lee from the Work Foundation says it's a big issue.
If you are a young person who does go through a period of unemployment, your wages can be low for the rest of your career, up until your 40s and your 50s. For the cities involved, I mean, it represents a loss of output. These people, because they're not earning, they won't be spending money in local shops, and so it can have a knock-on effect in local economies.
HSBC's customers are facing major problems paying for shopping or withdrawing cash. The company suffered a technical problem and their online banking system is also not working. The Greek Prime Minister could be ousted from power if he loses a vote in Parliament later. Meanwhile, G20 leaders meeting in Cannes are no closer to sorting out the Eurozone's debt crisis. David Cameron says British taxpayers' money won't be used to bail out EU countries. And Corrie, the musical, has been confirmed for a nationwide tour next year. The stage adaptation of the soap will tour arenas next spring. Paul O'Grady will narrate the look back of the last 50 years, along with cast members past and present. That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
Thanks to Red and Holly for the last hour of Wonderful Madness, but now it's the politics show. That is Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Ashley, Gus Hoyt. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the High Court's dismissed the last objections to expansion at Bristol Airport, just as the government say they want to reduce the use of fossil fuels. Hilary Byrne from the Residents' Campaign explains how this curious decision was made. And it's the 200th anniversary of the Luddites this month. They were a well-organised movement of machine breakers in the north of England. We hear about a forgotten BBC Bristol children's series on a Luddite theme. And in the light of the Occupy camps, look at some of Britain's historical social justice movements. Plus, from the privatisation of land to the privatisation of war. Former MI5 officer Annie Machon on the secret techniques of modern spies. And rolled over from last week, we take another look at the invite-only leadership charity Common Purpose. They train local authorities, the BBC and the police and other public services. But is there a conflict of interest when some of their graduates in public office place orders for more training from Common Purpose? Or are their courses so good it's public money well spent? That's in the second hour after six, but on to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs of 11, cloudier on Saturday, but sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, creeping up the temperatures, sunny on Monday, cloudier and showers for the rest of the week, though. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of November, highs of 13 Celsius, some hazy sunshine and windy. So should be some reasonable weather for the Trinity Centre's fireworks display this weekend. That was the Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest, and joining me now is Green Councillor for Ashley, Gus Hoyt. Hi, Gus. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tony.
Now, first of all, you're one of only two Green councillors we've got here in Bristol. What committees are you on?
At the moment, that question really should be, is what committees aren't I on? That's what it feels like. Ranging from everything from Developmental South through to CYPS, which is obviously responsible at the moment.
What's that stand for?
It's Children and Young People Services. I'm also on the committee for the Filton Airstrip development, which is a cross-party, cross-council committee. And to name but a few more, also one on sustainable transport.
So does it mean because you're actually a small party that you have to actually spread yourself a bit thinner and be on many more of the committees?
Absolutely, yes. With all the ward work as well, it's supposed to be a 2.5 day week, but most of the time I'm doing about 6 days.
Do you get any
days.
Sleep?
A little bit.
Okay, so which do you think is... you're on any of the planning committees? Because for a lot of people, that's one of the biggest decisions that the council's making. I mean, we'll be talking after the 6 o'clock news about Bristol Airport expansion. Mm-hmm. Are you on the planning committees?
Yes, I'm on... that's Developmental South. And that allows me then to be free within Ashley to actually campaign on behalf of local residents.
Why do you say that then?
Well, because if I was sitting on the Developmental North, which includes Ashley, if I actually campaign on behalf of an individual, I'm then not allowed to vote on it.
Well, what about, say, a big planning application, like, for example, the Bristol City Greenfield development on the football stadium? Mm-hmm. Would you be, as a councillor, able to express an opinion on that and then be on the committee too?
You're not supposed to, no. You're supposed to go into all these committee meetings with an open mind, which is quite ludicrous sometimes because some people are elected on certain issues and then once in power they're not allowed to actually express that opinion.
Doesn't sound very democratic to me.
No, not at all, no.
Okay. What about one of the big issues which is going to be affecting the city over the next six, eight months, which is this whole business of a police commissioner? They're talking about abolishing the police authority, which has got a spread of different councillors from North Somerset, other local authorities and from here in Bristol too, and having just a single elected police commissioner. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's absolute madness. As soon as you elect a police officer, the police commissioner, then they'll definitely pander, sorry to use the expression, but pander to the masses, as it were, the sort of Daily Mail readers and so forth. I lived in Colorado for about 2 years, and the elected judges would deliberately hand out extremely tough sentences just before their election would come up.
That's quite a strong word to use, madness. I mean, surely we can't be... the oversight of the police is one of the most particularly important jobs that our local authorities do. So, are you sure? Really? I'm not saying it's a strong word to use. Why such a strong...
If you just have one person in charge of all those responsibilities, it's just too much for centralisation of power. It could lead to... Well, trying to avoid sort of stronger language is really almost dictatorial behaviour.
I imagine that there is, you may find pressure on you in that sort of job for the police to be taking a specific line, possibly even, potential bribery of a particular... And if you're trying to bribe an entire committee, that's quite awkward, and you may find people that don't like it. But if you're trying to bribe just one person, that's a lot easier. This is basically an American system, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes.
And how does it work over there? You're saying that
it leads to extremely right-wing and reactionary policies as far as the legal system goes. I mean, just look at America. It's supposed to be, the land of the free, and yet it has the highest percentage of people in prison.
Now, the Green Party's known for its environmental stuff, Gus, but I'm going to ask you now a bit about the economic side of things, because I know the Greens have got quite a, a different view to some of the other main parties on the economy. Maybe you could just explain that.
Right, explain the economy in 5 seconds.
Well, just what your party's policies are to deal with the sort of cuts that we've got at the moment.
In regards to cuts, I think this is very much they're very much policy driven. That there are actually no need for them. If we were to call in, for example, all the corporate debt, which is caused by tax avoidance, there'd actually be very little need for the cuts at all. And of course, if we did cut the essential things such as the trillions spent on Trident.
But the argument here is, if you try and grab this tax, people run off, don't they? They move their money abroad.
That's what they say.
Not just their money, but sometimes their factories too.
That's what they say, but look at Germany. It has a much higher corporate tax than we do, and who's got the strongest economy in the whole of Europe?
Well, I can't answer that one. They certainly seem to be the tough guys in these Euro negotiations that have been going on this week in Cannes. Martin, let's bring you in now, old Labour Oxford economist. What are your thoughts about what's been going on this week? Because we've seen this peculiar situation with the Greek Prime Minister saying, I'm going to call a referendum on this whole business of whether we're part of the euro or not and the bailout fund. And then he says he's changing his mind because he's told that actually if he does call a referendum, he won't get the money. And then we hear afterwards that the Chinese aren't going to be contributing to the fund, so it doesn't look like he would be getting his money anyway.
I think, you know, they say a week's a long time in politics, and it's an eternity in economics these days. We nearly had a banking crash last week. We could still have one next week. I don't see any realistic sense in which the political leaders are going to be able to stop contagion from all of this spreading.
It sounds like some sort of like bird flu or something. What is this contagion?
Well, the fact is, you see, that lots of people... what we're talking about bailing Greece out is actually bailing out the banks who lent Greece money. Now, in actual fact, in a properly functioning capitalist system, if you lend people money and they don't pay you back, that's your lookout. That's why you get interest when you lend people money, because you're running the risk that you could lose it all. And obviously what should happen is these debts should be written off, but that means that's an end of the private banks. They've all got CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, on each other, so the system is completely interconnected. And just one small country like Greece going bust is enough to bankrupt the system. When bigger countries like Italy and Portugal and so on go bust, the system will definitely collapse. It's pretty horrendous.
But
how on earth did we get ourselves into this situation, we may well ask ourselves.
Well, what about the idea of the more powerful economies like Germany leaving the euro, so the euro then becomes really tailor-made for these weaker economies?
There are issues around the euro.
So you could have a kind of super euro with France and
Germany. Yeah, I mean, in actual fact, the euro was originally conceived was in fact just to be, you know, the Benelux countries and Germany. And of course, there are issues in the design of the euro and all the rest of it, but the euro isn't really the issue. The issue is the banks. The banks have been bust for 4 years. We've been chucking taxpayer money at them hand over fist, but it's a black hole. The derivatives market is at least 10 times bigger than the world economy on paper. So there's absolutely no way that chucking real money is ever going to dent the debts that have been run up.
So what about last week's rescue plan that was put together, signed and sealed, everybody seemed happy at the end of it. Now it seems to be falling to pieces.
Spin, basically. You know, they've tried to paper over the cracks, and of course the Greeks, at the end of the day, the Greeks cannot pay. This is why we've reached the end of the line. The austerity that has been demanded of the Greeks as a result, you know, in order to get the bailout money, has actually made their deficit worse, predictably it would.
But the Greeks are a bunch of tax cheats, aren't they?
No, the Greeks basically have got all of Greece, Portugal and Spain were fascist dictatorships until quite recently, so their tax system is completely biased in favour of the wealthy classes. But of course we can't raise the money. We all know, we were just saying earlier, if the Greeks try and raise money on the wealthy classes, they'll just run away, won't they? So of course they can't raise taxes on the wealthy classes, so they'll just have to go bust then, won't they, and carry the banks down with them. And I think people in Greece have reached the end of their tether. They can't see any point. And of course there's a rather nationalist tinge to what's going on in Greece. It's the Germans telling them what to do, the Germans that occupied them in the 1940s. And don't forget, there was a fascist dictatorship in Greece from 1967 to 1972-74, supported by the West, by the British, by the Americans. The Greeks remember. Most British people don't know. But in actual fact, yes, we backed a military dictatorship in their country in living memory. The Greeks all remember that.
Now, one of the vehicles, which is what they call these things, these financial vehicles, is the SPIV.
Yes,
I can't quite believe
this. The Special Program Investment Vehicle or something, the SPIV, yes. You couldn't make this up, could you?
And so, I mean, do you think that these, is there actually any kind of substance to these? Or are they, because we heard last week, didn't we, that it's actually a lot of the money that's going to apparently fuel this bailout is not real money. It's kind of insurance policies and
this kind of thing. It's basically, they're basically smoke and mirrors. You know, they're just trying to pretend that they can get a quart out of a pint pot. I mean, I think what's interesting in Britain, of course, is we've just started quantitative easing. Because we've cut the cuts that the government is doing is bringing the economy to its knees, so we print some funny money to try and get it up again. How stupid is that? They should just stop the cuts and switch off the money printer. But, you know, nobody seems to notice the contradiction here.
Well, one person that may have noticed that, if he's, I don't know if he's telling, but he may have noticed it, is the chief executive of Barclays, who did a rare appearance on the BBC today, very rare, in fact, and he was on the Radio 4's Today programme this morning talking about what do banks do. So let's have a listen to the chief executive of Barclays, Bob Diamond.
The importance of banks working closely with governments is they issue bonds to fund the deficit, working with pension funds to find the appropriate investments to get their returns at the right level, working with businesses to help them manage their risks of interest rates, of commodities, in order to raise funding and raise equity. A vibrant banking community working with a vibrant business community is going to lead to better economic growth and better jobs in the UK. And to do that, we need to restore trust in the banking system. And that was the theme of the speech.
So that's Bob Diamond there. Martin, he's talking about issuing bonds to fund the deficit. Well, the deficit is there to quite a large extent to actually pay back the banks. It sounds like it's going around in circles, this money.
That's right. We lend the bank, we give the banks a load of money. They then say to us, you can borrow it back provided you do X, Y, and Z. How stupid is that? We should cut out the middleman. If they're going to print money and give it to the ordinary people, why give it to the banks?
So how do you cut out the middleman then?
Well, very,
and if you do, very soon, the banks are just going to go bust.
Barclays claims it's making a profit. I don't think they are. If you look at their books properly, you'll see that they're carrying all sorts of collateralised debt obligations which are not worth what they claim they're worth. But because they pretend they're making a profit, they can pay out bonuses and they can pay off the shareholders. But at the end of the day, when banks go bust, we can buy them up for nothing. You don't have to pay for a bankrupt institution. You just say, we're taking it over. And that's how we'll get hold of them.
Gus, how do you take all this stuff? Because it sounds to what Marty's saying, that it's just almost fictional money going round and round from the banks creating it, giving it to the government, or lending it, to the government, then the government lending it back to the banks.
Absolutely, yes. The concept of money has changed drastically in the last 20 years. Realistically, it simply doesn't exist. One of the biggest sort of lies, I think, at the moment is that the way that we've simply changed the word debt into credit, and this has now created money for people to use. All of our economies are based on money that we have lent and interest that we're due in. It's absolutely fictional. There's nothing there. And the only way to stop this illusion, as Martin was saying, is simply to print more fake money and throw it at it.
So, Martin, how has credit become debt?
Because basically we've private... You know, do you remember back in the 1980s, we used to talk about monetarism and the government control of the money supply? Basically, that's been subcontracted to the private sector, to the banks. They create the money supply as debt. And then they lend it to people.
So our money system has been privatised. I don't remember seeing that one on the 9 o'clock news.
No, because most people find all of this a bit abstruse, and most of the time they're not very interested. But now, of course, they're suddenly getting very interested because it's starting to matter to them.
OK, let's have another listen to Bob. Bob Diamond, this is the Chief Executive of Barclays, speaking today. And here he talks about risk and the sort of risks that Barclays are taking.
This comes from the Governor of the Bank of England himself, Mervyn King. Executives at the top, bank executives, are earning vast sums beyond the dreams of ordinary people for doing a job which it's very hard to say justifies that kind of bonus. Agree with that?
We certainly understand that there's a debate about executive compensation, and I think with my role as chief executive comes the responsibility, just as you said, to both be responsible but also to operate competitively. Our customers and clients want us to put the best people in the jobs that take risk, in the jobs that cover clients, in the jobs that provide control. And so our job is to balance both being responsible, but also being competitive. In many of the businesses that we operate in globally, and we're competing with other global financial institutions. So I think that's the balance that we're constantly working on.
So Mervyn King's got it wrong, in that respect at least.
I don't really recall the quote.
Well, I can go on with the quote. He says it is a form of compensation which rewards gamblers if they win, but with no loss if they lose, and there is no doubting the rewards for top bankers.
I think everyone in society worries about the fact that financial institutions, there were definitely examples of pay for failure. There were definitely examples of banks having to take taxpayer money when things went wrong. We feel very strongly that that shouldn't happen, which is why some of the reforms in compensation, that it's better aligned with risk, it has stronger clawback, it has longer deferral periods. In our case, we paid some of our compensation in contingent capital last year. We have had changes in this regard, and I don't disagree that we have to balance being both responsible as well as competitive.
So you were overpaid. Just remind us how much you were paid in those good years. What was the best year you had?
It's really nice of you to try and turn this on to my compensation, but I'm going to be equally good at pivoting that this is not about me.
Bob Diamond there, the Chief Executive of Barclays, having a chat with John Humphreys this morning on the Today programme. Okay, so do you buy it, Gus Hoyt, your Green Councillor here in the city? What Bob is saying there, essentially, is that actually they're a part of a global problem.
Absolutely, it's completely systematic at the moment, or systematic. It's gone on for far too long. It needs drastic reviews immediately, really. The fact that he uses responsible and banking in the same sentence I find quite ludicrous, though.
Yeah, I think, going back to my point earlier, the banks are bust. Barclays is bust. If you look at the books properly and count the credit default swaps they hold at their real value...
But Bob is still getting his paycheck every month.
Yes, well, in actual fact, that's fraudulent, because if they were running any other firm in any other industry and they were actually bust, they wouldn't be allowed to trade. That's fraud.
So why aren't the fraud squad in Barclays?
Because
if they went
in and had a proper look at the books, they'd have to close them all down. And that's unthinkable, because we've got to have private banks, so we can't look at the books properly, so on we go, print some more money, on we go. But in actual fact, the obvious answer to all of this is look at the books properly, mark it all to market, which means that they're all bust, and then they can be taken over for nothing by the taxpayer, and then we can move on.
Now, on Newsnight one night this week, Alistair Darling, former Chancellor, the Labour Chancellor, was on there saying, actually, the politicians have actually got to get ahead of the changes that are happening in Cannes and in the Eurozone, and they're not actually thinking ahead of it. They're reacting to things as they happen rather than actually having any kind of plan.
Well, inevitably, that's the case. Don't forget, politicians are about getting elected every 4 years, listening to their constituents or whatever. Understanding what to do when you've got a nuclear explosion on your hands is not really what they're trained for. So, of course, they're running around like headless chickens.
But in
the past, we used to have politicians who knew what the financial markets were like and knew how to deal with them. This lot haven't a clue.
I'm sure Gus will say the Green Party actually does have a plan.
Well, yes, obviously, but then I'm just a politician, aren't I?
Yeah, so if you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes right now, Gus, what would you be doing?
Well, if I was sitting in with George Osborne's shoes, I'd be changing them pretty quickly for a start, that's for sure. The first thing to do, I think, is to admit that we need to nationalise the banks, really. That's the first obvious step.
Martin, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that does make sense. And the other thing, of course, is stop the cuts, and then you won't have to print funny money.
What funny money? What do you mean?
Well, the quantitative easing. Basically, Osborne's cuts policy has failed. The deficit is increasing. The economy is about to fall off a cliff. A series of economists this week, including Hun Chang, I think it is, the South Korean guy, have said we need a plan B. And quite a lot of liberal councillors have signed up to this and saying, look, we've got to have a plan B now. And in actual fact, plan A has failed. You know, the Osborne plan, let's cut our own throats, has failed. So he's got to have a plan B. He hasn't got one, but he's supposed to have one. And in fact, a plan B has been put forward. First of all, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Stop the cuts. First thing to do.
So we're in a situation with the euro crisis, as they like to call it, even though it just seems as if it's been bumbling along for such a long time, it can't really quite be a crisis anymore. The Greeks, for example, we're talking about in a couple of weeks' time not being able to pay any of their civil servants, to actually the entire country, the government, basically financially grinding to a halt.
Well, it's happened in third world countries loads of times.
It's almost like the bankers are sort of threatening them. They're saying, look, unless you sign this piece of paper here, we're not going to give you any money.
Well, the reason why the Greeks are fed up is because, as I said earlier, the austerity that's being forced on them is actually making their debt worse. And even the markets can see that. They can see there's no end in sight in this road. You force them to cut back, all that will happen is their deficit will get bigger, and therefore you won't be paid. Now, what debts that can't be paid won't be paid. That's what Keynes said in the 30s, and it's not a political point, it's a logical point. They can't pay, it's going to have to be written off, which means that the banks have got to take the loss, which means that they're going to go bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, they can be bought up for nothing.
Now, we're also talking about the IMF bailing out the euro, and we've just heard, this is sort of in the last 15 minutes or so, the G20 have failed to agree on any kind of IMF resources to help bail out the euro. So that leaves, as Paul Mason was saying on Newsnight last night, really just the European Central Bank is the only port of call left.
Yeah, what the British and the Americans want the Europeans to do is get the European Central Bank to print money. The Germans, who are the main influence in the European Central Bank, are not having it. Now, they could probably kick the can up the road. I mean, basically, the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve have been running the money press for a couple of years now. And they just want, you know, there's one more central bank to do this. If they could get the European Central Bank to switch the money press on, then they could probably pretend that they could run it for a little bit longer.
Now, they
longer.
Could only do that, surely, if the big countries like Germany were actually out of the loop.
Well, no, the point is that the Germans will not allow the European Central Bank to print money. They're not having any of it. It's part of German character. Yeah, they've set up the European Central Bank based on the Bundesbank, and they won't accept money printing.
So is the euro going to fracture then in the next week
yes,
or so?
Yes, of course it is. And when it does, the banking system will collapse. It's not the euro. The euro is just a symptom. The fact is that the banks are bust, and they've been bust for 4 years. Now, when Obama took over in America, he ought to have got a grip on the situation, but he didn't, because he's in the pocket of the Wall Street banks. That's the problem. The politics in the United States and here are in the pocket of the banks.
Well, we shall see next week if anyone's bitten the bullet and actually acted. Any of these governments have actually acted.
When they talk about what they want to do, though, Tony, what they're talking about fixing things is just basically coming up with some funny money to keep the show on the road. I think we're past that point now. More funny money to keep the show on the road. There's no point talking about that. That's not fixing anything.
Okay, on to our next story, and this is about the conviction of Vincent Tabak. First, then, we turn to this conviction for last year's Christmas murder of Joe Yates. It's come out after last week's conviction that police found witness evidence of Tabak's addiction to violent pornography, as well as alleged images of child pornography on his computer. But the Crown Prosecution Service decided it was not admissible in court. Martin, is that a good idea to have that kind of thing not admissible in court? It seems a little bit peculiar, because now we're in the situation where this information is just simply coming out through the press. It's not been tested in court either.
Well, I mean, it's hard to comment on an individual case about an individual person as a political commentator.
Now, this is about the CPS and whether that kind of information should have been available to the jury.
All I can say is if he's guilty, and it seems that he is, the Crown Prosecution Service have successfully prosecuted him and he's been sent and put away. And that's the result you want.
But there were apparently two people on the jury that thought he was not guilty or certainly weren't part of it. And this information that's come out since wasn't available
case. He pleaded manslaughter. So even the people on the jury voted against must be aware that he killed her, and he admitted that he killed her.
So you think it's okay to not to have this evidence in court?
I think this is a decision for legal people, because of course if you start twisting it too much, the jury might get sympathy for him. They think that you're actually you're painting his character black and all the rest of it. If you've got forensic evidence linking him to the murder, you don't have to bring anything else in. He did it. End of discussion.
Well, we're also talking about witnesses, call girls that he was with beforehand, for example.
Well, he sounds like a very sleazy character, doesn't he? Are we surprised? I don't think we are we?
But that's not the point. The point is, should it have been admissible in court or not?
I think anything is potentially admissible in court, but it's for the lawyers who are prosecuting the case to decide what goes forward and what doesn't, isn't it?
Okay, Gus, over to you on this one. What are your thoughts about this evidence of violent addiction to violent pornography, including also allegations of child porn on Tabak's computer? Should it have been available to the jury and for the solicitors to put across in court?
Well, at first glance, you'd obviously think it's hugely relevant, and yes, of course it should be. However, as Martin was saying, that's not really up to us to decide, and we don't vote jury cases on Twitter yet, so realistically, it is up for trained individuals to do, and I certainly have never trained nor want to train as a lawyer.
But politicians do set the law, and they will decide what can be admissible in court. Ultimately, politicians decide what the law is and what can be admissible in court or not. And do you think that there's a case yeah. here? Because when the case was all finished, we had in all the newspapers loads of other information about Tabak, particularly witnesses who could possibly have been in court but weren't.
Yeah, especially with the call girls and the violent strangulation porn, I think it was, wasn't it? To me, that is obviously very relevant to the case, and I'm not sure why that wasn't included.
Okay, Martin, we're going on now to talk about BBC Radio Bristol, and we've just had some, this is just the end of last week actually, the figures out for the listener figures for BBC Radio Bristol in this whole area and in the city, and they're down from what's called, it's actually a market share within the area over the 12 months. These figures are released every 6 months, and we've got the figure of 6.2% listeners in July, 4.2% listeners this time last year, and the latest figures out at the end of last week put Radio Bristol down to 4.2% of listeners. So they've gone down. Radio Bristol's listenership has actually gone down a half within the space of the last 12 months. Gus.
Well, to be honest, I actually don't get much time to listen to radio anymore, I'm afraid. I'm far too busy. But if the local BBC station is anything like Radio 4 on the Today Show, I've seen vast politicisation going on there recently.
How do you mean by that? On Radio 4?
On Radio 4, yes. It's certainly picking up the right-wing agenda a lot more now. And to be honest, I've regularly stop listening to that as well.
Well, there are some quite. I mean, I tend to listen on Radio 4 to things like Today in Parliament, Yesterday mm-hmm. in Parliament, and Prime Minister's Questions, things like that. Martin, what are your thoughts about these figures for Radio Bristol here?
Well, I mean, it's hard to comment. I mean, what's going on here? If I think is that people have now got a massive choice about what they listen to and how they get their news. I get my news from the internet. I read the English language press of the whole world, which is at my fingertips every morning. I don't just have to read a newspaper.
It's an indication, isn't it? That maybe the mainstream press is really not being listened to as much as it used to be.
No, I think one of the problems is that people then tend to select the news they read to reinforce their opinions. And because we've got a huge kind of variety of possibilities to get opinions from, you end up with a situation you've got in America where people listen to, crazy talk radio and think they're being given information. But at the end of the day, we've got an information explosion. And I think if the BBC wants to keep its audience, it's got to actually be, challenging in the way it approaches things. And, perhaps a bit more like us.
What about what Gus was saying there about this sort of move to the right, what he perceives anyway, at Radio 4?
Well, at the end of the day, the BBC is not directly funded by the government, but the licence fee is set by the government.
And also they have
if they don't do what the government wants, the licence fee negotiations could be rather fraught.
Yes, and the licence fee negotiations, the last ones, were fraught, particularly because Rupert Murdoch had insisted a big slice should be taken out of the BBC licence fee, and this is leading to quite a lot of job cuts.
Yeah.
In fact, there's some leafleting going on 8:30 in the morning on Monday outside the BBC about these job cuts locally here. It means programmes like the programme that one of the ones anyway that exposed the Bristol Babies heart scandal back 15 years or so ago, that won't be being made anymore here in Bristol. It'll be big cuts to
To be honest with you, I think public service broadcasting at local level, people dying on the vine, is not a positive thing. The BBC is a very flawed institution, as we all know, but by goodness, it's a lot better than some of the nonsense that you can find in the rest of the world, like Fox News. And I think, the BBC has got to actually live up to its reputation, and then people might listen to it more, be prepared to listen to it if it was going to actually take on the powers that be and all the rest of it. But of course, that requires them to be very independent in their journalism.
Well, Gus, as a Green councillor, you've obviously got your ear pretty close to the ground, and the grapevine is probably one of the most important places you get your news. But mm-hmm. where, if you're not listening to Radio Bristol, where are you getting your news from? Is it the internet or...?
Yes. I catch up on everything... on my smartphone.
Any favourite sites that you get news from?
To be honest, no. I've signed up on Twitter to many independent news suppliers and follow individuals who keep their ear very close to the ground, and just tend to sort of catch up on everything that way.
The idea is basically you're getting a little tweet every once in a while from a specific person. I mean, I signed up recently to Paul Mason, who's the Newsnight economics correspondent, who's over at Cannes at the moment, and you do tend to you can kind of specifically select the kinds of people that you like to listen to now, and it seems that people are doing that and not listening to the mainstream.
I was just going to add, or you can select, a wide variety of people, of course, which is what I tend to do.
But then you end up with tweet, 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 tweet the whole time.
I was going to say, I mean, the idea of my phone constantly getting messages does not appeal to me as a way to find out about things.
You'd rather be sitting there in your slippers with your pipe and maybe have a look at the internet once in a while, eh?
That's right.
Okay, so that's the Rajar figures, they're called. If you want to have a look at that on the internet, it's the Rajar. I've got their own website, and that's BBC Radio Bristol over 12 months, down from a market share of 8.4% to 4.2%. So I would imagine that there'll be some head scratching there over this week and over the next weekend. And also, as I said, to help save jobs at Radio Bristol, there's leafleting going on outside the BBC on Monday morning at 8:30. Now, on to Prime Minister's Questions, and this week, Wednesday, we had Ed Miliband talking about the Business Growth Fund and asking questions, of course, to David Cameron.
The Business Growth Fund was announced 9 months ago. It has 5 offices, it has 50 staff. How many investments? A grand total of 2. And Mr. Speaker, it's becoming a pattern with this Prime Minister. Fanfare announcement, then radio silence. He said in March, I'm going to watch those banks like a hawk and make sure they deliver. So what is he going to do to get the Business Growth Fund moving?
We have 190 billion of new credit this year, up from 179 billion last year. That is a huge increase. There is 76 billion of this is for small and medium-sized enterprises. That is up 15% on last year. We are seeing more bank lending under this government, but we're also seeing the bank levy so that people in the banks are helping to pay to deal with the deficit that his government created.
Over the last year, when many people have seen their wages frozen, directors' pay rose by 49%. Now, the Prime Minister expressed concern about this last Friday, but the public want to know, what is he going to do about it?
I think the Archbishop of Canterbury speaks, frankly, for the whole country when he says that it is unacceptable in a time of difficulty when people at the top of our society are not showing signs of responsibility. It's this government that is now consulting, but it is this government that's consulting about proper measures to make sure we get transparency in terms of boardroom pay, proper accountability, more power for shareholders, all of those things we are doing. And I have to ask him, if he's so keen on this agenda, what did he do for the last 13 years?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to put that to you, Martin, because what we're hearing here is that we've got 49% increase in directors' pay over the last year when wages for most of the rest of us have either fallen or been frozen.
Yes, and of course, falling real wages is a disaster for the economy.
But the point David Cameron's making there is that the divide in society was opened up under the last Labour government.
Well, indeed it was, and it was opened up to begin with by the Tory government that went before.
Yes,
but the problem with the 13
Labour?
Years of Labour government is that they were Tory light. They didn't do anything serious about tackling what was going on in the city at
who
all.
Who are Labour to criticise the present situation with 49% increase in directors' pay over the last year when you, as a party, did so much to increase the gap between rich and poor?
What happened was, in the last 30 years, we've had a neoliberal counter-revolution in economics, and everybody believed in the efficient market hypothesis, the Black-Scholes theorem, all of these clever ideas. And you know what? They were blown out of the water in 2008 with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. We've had a whole generation of nonsense. When I learned economics at Oxford University in the late 70s, we were taught that all of these ideas were bats, and serious people didn't take them seriously. And we've had a whole generation of Thatcher, Blair, Major, all of them buying into this rubbish. And in the old days, of course, Labour was a socialist party and it regarded the City of London as its sworn enemy. But we long ago gave up that sort of attitude, but we're going to have to relearn it.
Gus, what were your thoughts about these figures? Particularly, I mean, David Cameron was wriggling rather there at question time, but the figure over the last year of an increase in directors' pay while everyone else is having wages frozen, very, very low increases, or even dropped, 49% up in a year.
And employment down, of course. He just can't justify it, something such as that. The vast levels of inequality that we see in society right now are leading to all the problems that we see around us, everything from mental illness through to general happiness, to just absolutely everything.
Well, one of the other things that bothers me about big inequalities opening up in society is this actually kind of fosters the whole thing of extremism, racism, this kind of thing, because people always want to find someone down their own street to blame about it. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. You can't see them. Martin, is there any end to this?
Well, the real, you've just put your finger on what the real danger is. The banks are going to collapse, the economy is going to go down the drain, the deficit will probably increase, and because we haven't got a coherent mass movement putting forward alternatives yet,
Occupy movement. They have issued demands. Here in Bristol. They're in London.
Indeed, indeed, we're beginning to get there. We're about to have the first serious debate we've had about economic policy for a generation, because everybody thought they knew what was going on. And now it turns out that was all wrong. And it's quite clear that more equal societies are much better off than less equal societies. The spirit level by Kate Pickett and Richard Wilson show all kinds of stats.
Well,
taken as read,
the problem is it's getting worse, isn't it? We've just heard 49, that's 50% roughly, the richest in society have increased their own pay.
Yes, at the same time as many of the companies they're running, especially the banks, are bankrupt. and they shouldn't. That basically, what they're doing is fraudulent. And instead of saying, "Oh, if we raise taxes on them, they'll run away," they're saying, "No, you're fraudulent. You're carrying out fraud. We're going to confiscate all your assets, and we're going to put you in prison." That's what needs to happen.
Gus, do you think that there's a question of possibly here of a bit of short-termism, where people are seeing their
companies? Everyone's trying to grab what they can while it's still there.
They're seeing the companies a bit shaky. Looting. They're thinking, "Well, I'll tell you what. Before it goes down, I'm going to increase my pay and get as much as I can out."
You've actually just hit it right on the head. That's exactly what they're doing. They can see collapse looming, and they're trying to grab what they can to build their fancy castles.
It's what's known as technically as a control fraud. So these people are in charge, and they're running the banks down and lining their own pockets with what is basically public funds.
So
if I can just jump in quickly, what we need to bring in now is legislation such as no one can earn more than 10 times the amount that the lowest paid person in a company or organisation is paid. That would stop all this straight away.
And what would Chancellor Martin do then?
Well, I think the fact is what we need is a plan. We need to properly nationalise the banks, and we need to have a Green New Deal. We've got to have a vision of where we want to go. We've got to decide what we want to do, and then we've got to draw up a plan, and we've got to do it. And the private sector has got to be whipped into line. That's what we did in the 1940s. That's how we won the war, and we've got to get back to that kind of thinking.
Well, another event in Parliament this week was a very special debate on Wednesday, all about lobbying. And so here, as an extract from one of my favourite programmes, Today in Parliament on Radio 4 Long Wave, 8:30 a.m. in the mornings, here's Alicia McCarthy with a report on this look in the Houses of Parliament into the power of the lobbyists.
They're professional persuaders and deceivers, and MPs who accept money or hospitality from them are foolish and wrong. That was the Labour MP Paul Flynn's verdict on lobbyists, in particular those who campaign on behalf of rich and powerful companies. Mr Flynn sat on a committee that investigated lobbying in 2009.
We had one MP before us who was taking £70,000 a year from a commercial company, and his defence was the commercial company had interest in his department, they had jobs were going in his constituency, and he was doing his job as a constituency MP. The answer that the committee gave to him is we're all doing our jobs as constituency MPs, and we fight for jobs in our constituency, but we don't have to take a £70,000 bung for doing it.
Mr Flynn was speaking in a well-attended debate in Westminster Hall. He said lobbying was too secretive, but neither Labour nor Conservative governments had done much about it. Some MPs pointed out that charities and trade unions were effectively lobbyists as well. Others suggested that lobbying was a legitimate activity. Here's the DUP's Jim Shannon.
The MPs have a job to do, they have hard-held opinions that they wish to hold on to, and while lobbyists may come along and give them opinions and give them information, that's not wrong to do that, is it?
No, indeed it's not. Of course this goes on, this is part of the system. Lobbying lubricates the parliamentary system, and always has. I mean, we lobby, our constituents lobby, and of course that goes on. What we're against is what the Prime Minister called the corporate lobbying.
And Mr Flynn pointed out that former ministers found themselves in lucrative jobs with companies they dealt with when in government.
Who's to say that when a contract was awarded, sometimes for billions of pounds, there wasn't somebody didn't tip the wing, say, well, if you do this, if you go for company A rather than company B or C, we'll make sure that you're looked after, you get your hacienda in Spain.
He added that there was an incestuous relationship between lobbying and politics. Many MPs wanted to go on to be lobbyists, while some MPs were former lobbyists. But the Labour MP Chris Bryant pointed out that lobbying could help members better understand issues, in his case while scrutinising the mental health bill.
I knew remarkably little about mental health and the specifics of legislation, and if it hadn't been for a wide range of people who came to lobby me and argue about the different elements of the mental health bill, I wouldn't have been able to make as effective a contribution as I did.
In reply, the Minister for Political Reform, Mark Harper, said the code of conduct MPs were calling for was on its way.
We are committed to introducing a statutory register. We will publish our proposals for consultation before the end of this month. And then I hope we can engage in that debate. The reason why we're publishing them for consultation is very simple, and several members have alluded to this. We want to get it right.
The Minister for Political Reform, Mark Harper.
And that was a report from Today in Parliament earlier this week, all about a debate in Westminster about lobbying. Gus, what are your thoughts about this? And does the Green Party have a view generally about lobbying?
Well, obviously, there's lots of different forms of lobbying. As was brought up there, sometimes it can be just simply giving information. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think we need to, you know, one of our roles is to gather information from as many sort of wide sources as possible. As soon as you introduce money into the equation, it is very different indeed. Personally, I don't think anyone should earn another wage if they're working in politics. They shouldn't receive any income from any other bodies.
Martin?
I think that's right. I mean, if you're working for the local council, you're not allowed to have a job on the side doing something else at the same time. You're supposed to be turning up every day doing your proper job.
And
one of the things that's interesting development is...
No moonlighting, then?
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be allowed to do it in any other business, would you? You know, you're supposed to be spending your time, you know, and as we all know, I mean, some Tory MPs are wealthy, and go into politics because as a hobby. Others go into politics to end up being wealthy, and that's true of some Labour people as well.
But there's also a massive healthcare lobby behind this health and social care bill.
Well, in the United States, we've got that's the heart of darkness on this. The Supreme Court has now passed legislation that anybody can fund any political campaign completely secretly, and nobody's allowed to know who is funding what. So people are going to be bombarded with all sorts of information and misinformation paid for by corporate lobbyists, and they're not even allowed to know who is paying for it because it's all secret. Absolutely ridiculous.
So Gus, would the Green Party change the rules?
Well, I'd certainly hope so, yes. Like I said, I don't think anyone should be earning any more money outside of their daily job. As Martin said, moonlighting, basically, it's tantamount to. Obviously, something that you would have to then introduce, which sounds very self-serving, but it would be a livable wage. At the moment, obviously, a lot of councillors do have to work second jobs because the allowance is only about £11,000 a year.
Well, according to the lobbyists' public relations campaign, they're telling us the Westminster Hall lobbying debate we just heard a report on just then demonstrates a need for lobbyists.
It demonstrates a need for it to be regulated and absolutely transparent, yes.
Also, the big issue of pensions is looming, what with a potential enormous strike at the end of the month on the 30th of November. And Simon Jones now reports on the discussion today from Today in Parliament on the pensions. That's Simon Jones reporting now.
The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, was heckled at the TUC annual conference for saying that the unions had been wrong to strike in June over pensions. Several public sector unions are balloting their members over a mass strike planned for the 30th of this month. The current talks are based around proposals produced for the coalition by the former Labour minister, Lord Hutton. A Liberal Democrat, Stephen Williams, welcomed Danny Alexander's concessions.
What he has set out today is actually more generous to future pensioners and current employees than Lord Hutton recommended, while maintaining fairness for the taxpayer.
But there was criticism of the government's offer from Labour's John McDonnell.
The vast majority of public servants will still be paying more, will still be working longer, and actually will a significant number will still be losing out. The issue with regard to the protections for the lower paid will not affect a trained firefighter, a trained teacher, or a trained doctor, or many other public servants. The accrued rights that he's offered are actually a legal duty, and that actually he will be exacerbating the industrial relations climate by making an offer and then threatening to take it off the table at the same time.
His Labour colleague Geraint Davis went further.
What the statement consists of is that sacrificing long-term pension rights to pay for a short-term failure to stimulate economic growth. And what we see is that after 13 years of industrial peace, we see the return of mass strike action due to Tory economic failure and a threatening and mature approach to negotiation.
And we heard yesterday that Unison, the Public Servants Union, is going to be striking at the end of November. Gus, is this the right thing to do? Is it the right time to strike about this issue? Because the government's just put a new offer on the table and it's been thrown back in their face by the unions.
I think it's too late, to be honest. I think people should have been taken to the streets over a year ago.
Martin?
I think that's right. If trade unionism is not just about specific issues, you've also got to show who the daddy is, and the government's got to understand the public sector trade unions are fed up. The nation's fed up. We're all
fed
up.
The government is the daddy, Martin, not the unions.
No, they are. As the economy implodes, as we run into Christmas and into the new year, this government will fall, just like the Greek government.
The trouble is, Gus, that I mean, ultimately, there is a shrinking pot of money, and also people are living longer, so there has to be a realignment of public sector pensions. It's inevitable.
Yeah, I can understand how everyone wants to come up with some kind of sensible sensible agreement. Unfortunately, though, the definition of fair, which everyone seems to be operating from, I really don't understand where that comes from at the moment. If someone's worked all their life in a job or a considerable portion, they should be entitled to the pension that's provided. They take far lower salaries while they're doing that job than if they did in the private sector. And to me, this is yet another stance by the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats to march towards privatisation.
Yes, we heard Stephen Williams there really supporting this new offer and very much coming out against the who's our local MP here in Bristol, Lib Dem, against the idea of the strike at all.
Yep, and he's also, don't forget, a strong backer of the NHS bill, the reform bill that's going through. And of course, he's just
the privatisation bill.
The privatisation of the NHS, yes, or the further privatisation, I should add. And of course, you know, we all know he's a great champion of students.
Martin, what are your thoughts? Can you just round up these thoughts about the
point?
Let me just put a point to you, though, because there is, I mean, it's almost like the left is in denial about this. The unions are in denial. Yes, there is a contract for pensions, but the government is saying because people are living longer, particularly. And also because there's less money available in the pot to pay those pensions, there simply has to be a realignment of that contract.
Now, this whole question of less money available, why would that be? It's because we're trying to get the deficit down by cutting public expenditure.
Okay, but are people not living longer then?
I think it's good that people live longer. We are a wealthy society.
So then that money has to be spread out, surely.
There is an increase in a normal capitalist economy. Every year there's a 3% increase in productivity just through the normal run.
But that money then has to be spread out, surely, if people are living longer.
Yes, and we should spend more money on looking after people and less on weaponry and useless
tat. But that's not what I was asking you. I was asking you about you should spread the money a little bit more thinly because people are living longer.
Look, you've got to understand, when somebody signs up, having left school or university, to work, for example, as a nurse, they sign a contract which includes a pension, and that is a contract between them and their employer, and they can't turn round 40 years later and say, oh, I'm sorry about that, we're not going to just as the bankers claim that they've got to have their contracts fulfilled, so have public sector workers. And if you've been a fireman, think about what firemen do every day. They scrape people up off the M32 every day of their working lives. At what point are they going to be allowed to retire and have a rest?
All right, I'll give you the final word on this, Gus. Are you going to be there on the 30th?
Absolutely, yes.
All right, on to another story. And the MPs need Prince Charles to approve new laws. This is a fascinating one. Campaigners reacted with fury after it was revealed that ministers have been forced to get Prince Charles's backing for dozens of new laws over the past decade. The Prince has a veto over bills affecting the Duchy of Cornwall, Earldom of Chester, and the Principality of Wales under ancient royal and parliamentary rules. The power has applied to 34 pieces of legislation since 2001, covering everything from shipwrecks to coroner's courts and the Olympics. Now, Gus, I'm first on this one. I didn't realise that Prince Charles had a veto on so much of our legislation. I thought we were a democracy.
It was a great shock to all of us, I think. I actually found out about this on breaking news via Twitter. Yeah, it's absolutely preposterous, really, that one of the members of the royal family in a democracy can have the power to veto.
But he's a decent chap, isn't he? I mean, you know,
he's obviously not used it correctly then, has he?
Well,
he could have vetoed a lot of the recent policy.
In a country where the Prime Minister and Parliament has to go, basically, to get the royal assent for every bill that's passed. And I suppose there's always the possibility that the royal will say, no, I do not give my assent.
There is a bit of a difference. Assent by the Queen is a formality. This is a veto.
So a formality. What do you mean? The Queen can't say no to sign legislation.
She has to. We fought a civil war over that, if you remember, before our time.
Well, it seems that there was a settlement after the Civil War, wasn't it, where they brought back Charles II, and so we do actually have an arrangement which is a kind of partnership between Parliament and the government and the royals.
Yes, and our constitution is a thing of wonder to behold, isn't it? Look at the way the Corporation of London, we found out who they are. They run the square mile. They're not answerable to anybody. They're not answerable to Parliament.
The Queen has to ask permission to enter, actually, yeah.
Yeah, It's a state within a state, isn't it? What other states within a state have we got?
And while we're on the subject of Prince Charles, we also hear this week in the Daily Mail that he's been fighting a 10-year battle to protect Dracula's home, and his yearning has a yearning for Transylvania. This was in the Daily Mail, this one. Now, apparently, Prince Charles is actually descended for, at least he believes he was descended from Count Dracula. Have you heard this one before, guys?
It was news to me.
And so, do you think it's a good thing for the Prince of Wales to be doing, to looking after this castle all that way away?
Well, yes, perhaps he should go there permanently.
Okay. All right, we've got just one more, I think, one more story. Here, that is that criminals are, this was the last weekend, this one, criminals are to have to pay weekly benefits docked, but by up to £25 to pay fines. And this is people on benefits who are fined in court could face a fivefold increase in the amount docked from their weekly payments to cover the penalty, David Cameron announced last Saturday as the government response to the riots intensified. Gus?
Yeah, this is just another march towards Dickensian England that all the Etonian boys that are running this country think were the glory days of Britain.
That's quite right. They're just trying to turn the clock back.
I'm a bit concerned about this one, because obviously if people are getting benefits and having £25 a week taken off their benefits, they are actually going to be below the legal amount of money that they need to live on.
I think every politician should have to live at least 6 months on benefits.
Well, David Cameron said, apparently, people need to understand if they commit a crime, they will face the consequences. The system, as it stands at the moment, is far too soft and does not send the right signal.
Or we could fix society in the first place.
Yeah, and of course, don't forget, you're encouraging criminality by doing this, of course, because there is a way for the people to solve the problem. It's to go out there and deal some drugs, do some knockoff. We're going to have, you see in Mexico, 40,000 people killed in drug-related violence the last 3 years, and as we modernise and become more American, that's where we're going.
Yeah, and just to bring in quickly the American rule, which they have there, is the three strikes, you're out. You know, three times that you break the law, and it can be as small as shoplifting, and you go down for life. That just means that once someone's convicted twice, you know, they start carrying a gun because they're never going down again.
They've got something like 10% of all the prisoners in the world, I think, in the United States. Yeah. Ian Duncan Smith is
running to profit.
The DWP, Department of Work and Pensions Minister, is Ian Duncan Smith. He said on this, he welcomed the change. I want to see responsibility and fairness restored to the welfare system, and there can be no clearer example of this than when someone has committed a crime that they face losing a significant amount of their benefits. The summer riots showed that for many people, the present system didn't make them think twice about what they were doing.
Listen, we've got young people in this country with no hope, no future, no chance of a proper job, and staring into the future.
You're being very negative. Surely they should be trying to get a job.
Surely the government should be planning the economy to make sure everybody got a flipping job. Who's responsible for the mess? Is it these youngsters? Well, many of them with poor education, they've been failed by everybody, and then they lash out. What do they expect? Those riots in the summer, you know, that's just the beginning. It's really going to get going in the end, and people are going to, if they think that was a summer of rioting, they should cross over to the United States or Mexico or Greece, and we'll see what it looks like.
Gus, what do you say about Ian Duncan Smith's comment that for many people the present system didn't make them think twice about what they were doing during the riots? He went on to say the Prime Minister and I were clear we would look at all parts of the benefit system so they would feel the full effects of their actions.
That's exactly what I'd expect him to say. I'm surprised they didn't move on to say that they were going to reintroduce caning and capital punishment. Really?
Send them all to Australia. That's the obvious answer, isn't it?
Politicians?
No.
Okay. Well, that's it for the time being, and we're coming up now closely to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, who was Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, that's Gus Hoyt. After the news, the High Court has dismissed the last objections to expansion at Bristol Airport, just as the government say they want to reduce the use of fossil fuels. Hilary Byrne from the Residents Campaign, people living around Bristol Airport, explains how this curious decision was made. Also, it's the 200th anniversary of the Luddites this month. They were a well-organised movement of machine breakers in the north of England. We hear about a forgotten BBC Bristol children's series on a Luddite theme. And, in the light of the Occupy camps, look at some of Britain's historical social justice movements. That's coming up after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 6.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky.